The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hello, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 19th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is so great. Thanks so much for listening. You're gonna enjoy this. I mean, around America today, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, there are going to be people screaming at their radios and their headphones listening to this, because we're going to get right to it. The third and final debate of the 2016 presidential race is set for tonight. And what can you possibly need to hear to make up your mind, you're saying, between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and the other candidates, or even staying home if that's an option for you? Well, they are all options for our three voters from three decisive states with three distinct experiences of being undecided. You're going to say, where did they find these people? Hey, we're just that good. And we spent a good bit of time today talking to them and hearing how their positions have evolved. And you're going to hear some very tasty excerpts. So here we go. Please welcome.
Hi, my name is Gabby. I am a 22-year-old millennial living outside of Philadelphia in Bensalem, Pennsylvania, and I'm currently an undecided voter.
I am Cheryl, and I'm 61. I live in Marco Island, Florida, and I'm just hoping that tonight we have some strong feelings on a direction to go.
I'm John. I'm 33, which is a borderline millennial. It's kind of pushing the boundary a little bit, but it's still, I guess, technically a millennial. I'm from Northeast Ohio, and I've been an undecided voter for pretty much this entire election cycle. I have voted at my first year that I was eligible to vote was 2004. I've been in line early morning to vote for every single Democratic candidate since then, and if I don't go vote that morning, I'll be thinking about it the entire day and wishing that I felt compelled to.
All right. What do you need to hear in the debate, John?
For Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party to admit that maybe they've lost their way in the past 35 years and take accountability for their own actions. I'm obviously no GOP supporter, but trying to frame them as the only reason that the middle class has suffered for the past 35 years is entirely false and very, very misleading. It builds up this us versus them mentality that makes it even harder to get anything substantial done in this country.
A mea culpa from Hillary Clinton is what you're looking for, John. Gabby?
I actually wrote down a little checklist of things that I really wanted the two candidates to talk about. First is I want to hear more about Social Security. I feel like the past two debates, it's barely been mentioned. I feel like it's a major issue that as millennials and also like Cheryl, we have baby boomers. It's something that we both have to really sit down as a country and really address. And I really want to hear more about that. I also want to hear more about race relations in the United States. As an African-American female, also I'm biracial. So I have weird situation. Half of my family is Caucasian, half is African-American. So for me, what I want to hear is how to really meld the country together race-wise, because the last debate, the second debate, I absolutely detested Donald Trump's answer, which was, hey, we need to increase stop and frisk. And I felt like since he was giving such a lack of policy, the Hillary Clinton didn't have to try. So I had one candidate not really discussing the issue with any empathy or sympathy and effort. And I have another candidate saying, oh, well, to increase race relations and to strengthen African-American communities, we should implement and increase a use of a policy that's extremely controversial. I just was absolutely just distraught by both of their lack of answers. I also want concrete answers for fixing climate change. Also, hopefully get some more answers when it comes to our true reliance on energy, because I was looking up fact-checking sites and Hillary Clinton said we're actually energy independent, which is 100% false. We are not energy independent. I really want the candidates to touch on certain things like Islamophobia. I felt like both of their answers were not very informative at all. None of them are really concrete things to bring me into each candidate. So those are certain things I would like to be.
So Hillary concerns you on Islamophobia. How does Hillary concern you on Islamophobia?
she's such a tailor-made politician that I don't get a real sense of empathy or sympathy from her answers. One comment that I was, when I was watching some of the major news networks and listening to their pundits, the political pundits, was stating that Hillary Clinton has been working in government and trying to help the American people through her, you know, her work for two decades, how long, like 30 years, Donald Trump quotes. So she should have concrete answers and concrete examples of interacting with Muslim individuals and Muslim Americans. And her answer sounds so tailor-made. There was no sympathy or empathy or actual real life context to it.
All right, Cheryl, what do you need to hear from the debate?
Okay, well, first I want to touch on the fact that Jonathan is considering not voting. And last night at dinner, my son, who's 32, shared the same feeling that he and his wife were not even going to vote. And I personally had I have a problem with that. And I have some time. And I'm not going to tell them to vote or how to vote. But because they have a one-year-old, I'm going to tell them there's one strong reason they have to vote and let them go with that. And it's because they just have to do it for their son. And our country needs a lot of changes, and no one will disagree with that. And I will vote, but right now as I sit here, I do not know which way I'm going. And I'm hoping tonight that I feel confident, and I'm still wanting Trump to grow up and impress me, because I feel he has the right tools.
All right. Isn't it interesting that for all three of you, you're very sophisticated on content and issues. You all have very issue. You're very strong on issues and what you believe in and what you think about, whether you're leaning towards Bernie Sanders or leaning towards the conservative sort of Reagan agenda, Cheryl, John, and Gabrielle. But it's a quality of the individual candidate that has to come out. Donald, grow up. Hillary, show me some empathy. Hillary, show me that you're not tailor-made and sort of just pandering. These are the things that have to come out in the debate. It's personal and emotional that's really on the line tonight. Would you three agree?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I couldn't agree more with Hillary Clinton. To me, always sounds like a talking points algorithm instead of a real person. It's never spontaneous. It's never, and I pretty much disagree with everything Donald Trump says, but what he says doesn't sound that way. It sounds like it's actually a person talking. It doesn't sound like it was just someone reading from a script. And having just a moment of humbleness and a moment of spontaneity would go a long way with me with Hillary Clinton.
I also agree with John. When it comes to listening to a lot of what Donald Trump says, I can completely agree that even though it might not be what I agree with policy-wise or opinion-wise, just hearing his responses, when something is said and he immediately reacts with maybe, you know, something upsets him, or you can see his emotion. In such a time span where we've had some of the worst economic problems in our country since the Great Depression, these couple of years, these two Obama presidencies, it brings a lot of emotion out of people. And to see a presidential candidate show, hey, when I hear something that makes me upset, I experience these emotions just like you, the American people, experience these emotions. And that's why I think that Donald Trump appeals to so many people, because you can physically see his reactions, physically see his excitement about galvanizing his support basis and, you know, getting the voters out there. And I feel like with Clinton, that's what I'm lacking from her, is that we have an extremely animated nominee to the right, and then we have such a, you know, lack of animation to the left, where she's so used to giving these tailor-made responses and tailor-made speeches that she's been prepping for days on. It just seems like there's no emotion when so many American voters are so emotional. We need somebody from both sides that can give emotion and vilify what we've been feeling. And I feel like Hillary Clinton doesn't do that. And that's what I personally really need from a presidential candidate, is someone who understands how I feel.
The sound of three undecided voters from three in-play states in the United States. This is the takeaway. All right, the E factor for emotion, Cheryl. What's the emotional factor you need from Trump that's gonna move you back into his column?
he needs to lighten up and not make it all about him. He takes everything so personal. He needs to be one of us. He needs to be on our side and let his ego go. And Hillary is so stiff, and she looks like a robot. She just doesn't have any love in her. She's loveless.
What's the greater likelihood, do you think, tonight? Hillary Clinton showing authenticity or Donald Trump putting his ego aside and acting like one of us, as Cheryl so perfectly put it? Gabrielle?
I think that Donald Trump is going to try to be a little bit more laid back, a little bit more presidential. If he can do that, he can possibly, you know, really sway voters like Cheryl, you know, some Republicans or independents on the fence and some Democrats that might vote for the Republican.
All right, John?
The emails coming out are too damaging to, at least for me, to expect her to fully confront them publicly.
But in terms of character, you think it's a higher, you think it's a lower percentage shot for Hillary Clinton to be authentic and spontaneous than it is for Donald Trump to put his ego aside?
At least for him to make the appearance that he is, I think it's more likely for him to try and take a humble approach to this debate than it is for her to fully confront these issues on TV. And that doesn't mean at all that I am going to be sympathetic towards Trump. I wouldn't even take the appearance of him appearing more humble as authentic either. I mean, I think both candidates have a huge problem with authenticity, no matter how they want to portray themselves.
All right. What's more likely, putting ego aside or showing authenticity by the first woman candidate to be president? Cheryl?
For the first time, we all agree. I'm going to go with Trump. I don't know if it's possible for Hillary to, I don't think she's capable of changing her demeanor, the way she comes across. My feeling is Trump could pull this off.
That makes for a decisive and very high stakes debate tonight from our three undecided voters here. Cheryl from the swing state of Florida, Jonathan from the in-play state of Ohio, and Gabrielle from also the in-play state of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Undecided, and it feels so lonely.
Undecided, I could vote if only
there was one perfect fit.
But I just can't pick, 'cause I'm so misguided. I'm undecided. Hey, hey.
They're not the Ohio players, they're the Takeaway players. We will check in with Gabrielle, John, and Cheryl immediately after the debate as part of our live call-in coverage, Debate Rewind. That's tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a live call-in show hosted by Todd Zwillick. Are you still undecided, Gary, Indiana? I'm leaning Hillary, but I'd like to hear her talk more about getting corporate money out of politics. Are you still undecided? There's still time to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to Facebook. We're at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Is this election for real? You may have said that to yourself for over a year now for a whole variety of reasons. Maybe the rhetoric, the very untasteful allegations and references you've heard. Our undecided voters told us earlier this hour they seem to hear nothing but a drone of recorded talking points coming from Hillary Clinton. But one aspect of Donald Trump's latest message has caught the outraged attention of the man who has the job in the White House that Donald Trump wants.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized, and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past, or that there are instances in which that will happen this time. And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes.
President Obama went out of his way yesterday in the White House Rose Garden to say that Trump's claims of voter fraud in November are wrong and maybe dangerous. A Clinton landslide, as shown by some polls, simply can't be manufactured. The swing states of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Colorado now show a narrower path to victory for Donald Trump. The Princeton Election Consortium predicts a 97% chance that Hillary Clinton will win next month. Nate Silver at 538 has the probability of a Clinton victory above 85%. That progress for Hillary Clinton may have more to do with Donald Trump's missteps than any conspiracy. But does this kind of talk get Donald Trump votes? Or is it Trump playing for a disturbing Plan B the day after Election Day? Here's Donald Trump Monday night in Wisconsin.
So many cities are corrupt and voter fraud is very, very common.
Joining us now is Joshua A. Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky. He's an election law and voting rights expert. Welcome, Joshua.
Thanks.
Very, very common. Is that something that is even remotely true that Donald Trump is saying there in Wisconsin?
Not even close to the truth. Voter fraud is a very small part of our election system. I'm not going to say it does not exist, but it exists at such a minuscule level that it couldn't possibly affect the presidential election.
What is the scale of these stories that we hear? And there are actually stories out now by this news service Veritas that suggests that voters coming from other states have been bussed into Wisconsin. We had Newt Gingrich over the weekend saying that everyone knows, every serious historian knows that the election of John F. Kennedy was stolen by the Democrats with some voter fraud that took place in the city of Chicago. How do you evaluate these individual dead people voting charges, that sort of thing?
Well, these are mostly allegations that are not yet proven. I mean, the Project Veritas video, it's not clear if it's the full video or if it's spliced together like a lot of their previous videos. And I'm looking for the evidence of the type of voter fraud that Donald Trump has been espousing that exists actually affecting an election. You know, he talks about voter fraud at the polls. The only thing that could happen there is in-person impersonation, someone showing up to the polls and pretending to be someone they're not, or trying to vote 5, 10, 15 times, he said that. And the evidence is that just does not happen. You know, of course, maybe there's an isolated instance here or there, but not in any way that could actually affect the huge presidential election with the number of votes. And you know, the other thing that, you know, President Obama said, you know, that we have a decentralized election system. You know, we don't have one election system. We have 8,000 to 10,000 election systems all happening at the same time on Election Day, each in your individual precincts. And so to have a conspiracy so vast that he suggests that it could throw the presidential election is just mind-boggling and impossible.
So the scale of these kinds of allegations is minuscule compared to the millions that would have to be moved to make that credible. That's number one.
Right. And, you know, the evidence of voter fraud that we have seen existing that actually happens very occasionally is through absentee balloting fraud and then very occasionally through complicit poll workers. And that usually occurs in a local election to try to influence an election that's only going to be won by a couple of votes because there's not a ton of people voting in it.
We're talking with Josh Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky. This is The Takeaway. There's some talk that the media is trying to overcompensate by going against Donald Trump at this point in the campaign, and that's going to be decisive.
Look, I mean, I think the media is reporting what it's reporting. It's reporting based on the debates. It's reporting based on the stuff that's coming out. And so, you know, I think that, as President Obama said, Donald Trump should be making his case to the voters to try to win votes. And not be suggesting that the forces are out against him. Again, we have a system in which we all gear up toward Election Day. We cast our ballots. We count them. The process is fair. The process is transparent. The process is open. Millions of people are watching. And we have a system in which we expect that after Election Day, we come together and rally behind the person that has won. I think Trump's rhetoric is calling that into question, and I'm very concerned that, you know, if he does come out not on top on Election Day, that he tries to continue the fight, and you know, his supporters, you know, will turn to more dangerous activities.
Joshua A. Douglas is professor of law at the University of Kentucky, election law and voting rights expert. He spoke to us from Lexington. Joshua, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko meet today in Berlin alongside their French and German counterparts. The goal is reaching peace in eastern Ukraine. Can that even happen? It's the first time the four leaders will have gathered in more than a year since the only partially successful Minsk agreement, that 2015 agreement, helped to end large-scale battles in the fighting. But it's continued. More than 10,000 have died since the start of hostilities between Russia and Ukraine more than 2 years ago. Oleh Rybachuk serves as chairman and co-founder of the Ukrainian NGO Center UA. He's also former chief of staff to Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko. Welcome to The Takeaway, Oleh.
Thank you.
Does Vladimir Putin hold all the cards in these talks?
No, not at all. Never so little under his sleeve as today. His visit to Berlin is rather imposed on him because he made a number of defiant statements saying that he believes it makes no sense to go unless the world will respond to his demand. The world and Ukraine is part of it. Ignore his demand, but still he must go because he feels pretty isolated. He was supposed to be today a guest of honor in Paris, but that visit was killed by French.
So do you think that the settlement of these talks will result in an end of hostilities?
No one. It's amazing that yesterday only there was this news that finally this year the heads of four states formed a meeting and all confirmed, and immediately Ukrainian president, then Russian president, then Chancellor Merkel said that they do not expect any breakthrough for this meeting. So there is almost unilateral understanding that there will be no breakthrough.
So what could possibly be the purpose of this meeting if hostilities can't end? Will there be any evolution of where Ukraine will sit in Eastern Europe, even if it ends up divided?
Ukraine, it's not about Ukraine being divided. It's about Ukraine occupied by regular Russian troops, and Putin pretended they are not there. He was talking the same thing about Crimea. The test is actually not so much to Ukraine as to Germany and France. Will they demand that Russian troops withdraw first, and then we'll start talking about possible elections? Because I don't remember in the world history occupied territories electing somebody. Putin would like to create the new era, probably. But Ukraine now is as united as never before against Putin and against Russia. The result of the war, Putin was the most popular politician in Ukraine just before he annexed Crimea. Now, most part of Ukrainian army fighting Russian army are Russian-speaking Ukrainians.
So, but again, I'm a little perplexed. I mean, Putin can do whatever he wants. The Russian people will support him. The Ukrainians don't have the military capability to push the troops out of Ukraine right now. These talks, you've already described them as they're going to be pretty tense.
No, they would be without any result and no expectations from none of the participants. They said that publicly. Putin's office, President's office, Merkel's office said that we don't expect any breakthroughs from this meeting.
So then the future for your people, Ole, is a continued conflict and a dream of returning Crimea to Ukraine.
No, the dreaming, sir, is not enough, as you may guess. What changed dramatically? We are now much stronger. Putin lost his momentum. Actually, he was having wrong expectations. He believed that he would be welcomed by absolute majority of Russian-speaking Ukrainians. He believed that his idea of Russian world would practically allow him to annex the rest of Ukraine, like two-thirds of Ukraine, like he annexed Crimea. He never expected such a heavy resistance. He paid heavily. He lost, in 6 months of war in Donbas, he lost more special troops than in 15 years of war in Afghanistan. So he was inflicted heavy military casualties. Now he is also paying dearly financially. again, those Americans, price for gas and oil as low as ever, no access to capital market. That's why he demanded from U.S. to compensate sanctions and to get Russia out of sanctions. So he can drag on with this situation a year max because he's running out of reserves. So there is no win perspective for him.
Oleh Rybachuk serves as chairman and co-founder of the Ukrainian NGO Center UA. He's also former chief of staff to Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A story now of the limits of laws in making women free of archaic traditions about sex and pregnancy in the nation of South Africa, which we think of as free of apartheid. It is not free of outmoded traditions, though, when it comes to reproductive health. The Constitution, passed in 1996, says abortion is legal and everyone is guaranteed health care. But education and outreach has lagged over the past 30 years, and many young people still feel ashamed talking about sex and their identity, which has meant unequal access to health care for women. Dr. Talang Mofokeng is a medical doctor specializing in reproductive health at a women's clinic in Johannesburg. She explained her continuing challenges in a conversation that's part of our collaboration with News Deeply, exploring women's issues in the developing world.
We have a lot of cultural and also religious people in South Africa. And one of the things that happened, you know, last year was that young girls were being tested for virginity as a measure of whether they meet the requirement to study at a tertiary institution. And as one of the things that I was campaigning for as an advocate was to say, but this is not really a fair academic or even a merit test to see if someone deserves an education or not. And as a country that signs all of the sustainable developmental goals, it really is working counter to that, where we're saying we want to keep young girls empowered with education because we know education is important. That had to be taken to the Human Rights Commission in South Africa, where they made a ruling to say, in fact, this is unconstitutional and you cannot burden the girl child.
What's the state of law for abortion in South Africa, and what do women think the state of the law is?
All right. The law made abortion legal 20 years ago in South Africa. And in fact, we are planning to have a series of celebrations in honor of this Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act. But here's the interesting fact. 30% of South African women still think abortion is illegal. And that is a big problem because it means 30% of women are having unsafe procedures, many of whom end up with a lot of morbidities, and some of them die from unsafe procedures. And half of the problem is that there's no information. You know, there's information about condoms, there's information about diabetes, there's information about high blood pressure, but you will struggle to find information on abortion and abortion care, even on the National Health Department's website. You know, sometimes I see women, young people who have bled for days and days and days from, you know, an illegal provider, number one, but also from having an unsafe procedure. And they come to us with complications and you know, we have to obviously assist them. It's a problem. It's really, really a big problem for us at the moment.
How linked are reproductive health rights in South Africa and human rights in your view? And does South Africa need to have more clarity in the laws that it passes for young women?
Our laws in South Africa, you know, do go a long way. And if you compare South Africa to the rest of the African continent, we really are more progressive and we're more inclusive. But we still lack very much in terms of implementation. And I think that's where the frustration is, because a lot of us appreciate that in South Africa, we do have good laws. And what they do need is to have more regulations, have more policy analysis, which is where I come in, you know, as an advocate for reproductive justice, is this continuous policy analysis to make sure that it's aligned, not only to human rights, but to the Constitution. You know, people are shy to come to doctors or nurses to speak about it. But also you find that the doctors themselves and the nurses may not have had comprehensive sexual health education. Therefore, you can't give to your patients what you yourself don't have, which is another side of what I do in terms of sexual health education. But, you know, it's more like training the trainer or educating the educator. That's the way that we need to look at it. That's how far back we need to start.
Dr. Mofa Kang's story came to us from News Deeply's Women and Girls Hub, which reports on issues affecting women and girls in the developing world. To find out more, visit newsdeeply.com/womenandgirls. On November 8th, Florida voters will have a second chance to pass a medical marijuana amendment that was narrowly defeated 2 years ago. Opponents believe even this revised amendment could result in a drug epidemic similar to one faced by the state several years ago. But supporters say that access to medical marijuana is not sufficient in Florida, even though laws have been loosened. Jeff Brandis is a Republican state senator in Florida, opposed the amendment back in 2014, now in favor of it. Senator Brandis, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What's changed here? I mean, is the impetus of this amendment or is this of this ballot measure to get access to people who are in medical need of marijuana?
Well, I think what's changed really is we've tried to move a bill through the legislature for the last 2 years. Originally, I didn't support the bill or the amendment back in 2014 because, you know, constitutional amendments are essentially take it or leave it offers. They don't offer themselves to amendment during the process or why people are voting. They're really take it or leave it offers to the people of the state of Florida. And I thought the better way to do it was to vet it through committee, answer some of the questions, have public testimony, kind of do it, use the process. And put forward two bills, one in 2014, one in 2015, on that topic and with the desire to have the conversation. But my colleagues had no desire to have the conversation. And so now, you know, we're left with a position of, I still think the best way to do it is through committee, but I'm not willing to wait 10 years. And so people in my state want to have access. We saw this in 2014 where 58% of Floridians voted for medical marijuana. In Florida, we need 60% to put something in the Constitution.
So do you think the position of Attorney General Bondi is the key here in that she's decided not to oppose this ballot measure?
No, I mean, I think, you know, this has gone through our Supreme Court. They've reviewed the ballot language. They've agreed to, that it should go on through the Constitution. They've gotten the required number of signatures from Floridians, and those have been validated. So they've followed the exact right, the correct process, and I think they've really tightened the language down. This is a very different constitutional amendment from 2014. This one is much tighter, much more focused, handles children in a very different way, and it really addresses some of the concerns that the critics had back in 2014 that I think many were legitimate.
And so you think this is in large part a realization that basically the majority of Floridians want something like this to pass, and this is the one.
That's correct. I mean, I think our polling shows that where it's polling over 70%. That's a super, you know, incredible majority. We had the ultimate poll because we actually had a very similar language back in 2014, and we had 58% of Floridians vote for it. And, you know, speaking to my colleagues in the legislature, I think there's a vast majority of them that support this policy and want to see us move forward.
Why not go all the way towards legality like the state of Washington or Colorado?
It's just not. I don't think anybody's there yet. I don't think there's the 60% votes there for that. I think even moving that through the legislature would be exceptionally difficult, seeing how difficult it is just to discuss medical marijuana. I think we're having a discussion, and I think that's the important piece. And right now, we're focused on medical marijuana and having individuals have access to that.
What is this charge that continues to be surfaced by opponents that a drug epidemic may result as a consequence of this law passing?
Well, I think the you know, my constituents are concerned more with distribution facilities, that they don't want distribution facilities on every street corner. And I think that, well, I know the constitutional amendment provides the legislature with some authority to regulate. And so we'll allow the cities and counties to regulate how how the distribution centers are set up and how many can go in each city or county, those types of things. And that's really, if you talk to my constituents, that's their number one issue. On the issue of kind of this drug epidemic, you know, nobody has died, to my knowledge, in, you know, from an overdose of medical marijuana. And so we have a huge crisis in opioids, though, in Florida and around the country. I mean, Florida was for years considered the pill mill capital of the United States. And it's personally affected my family in with that epidemic. And so, you know, I think the story really needs to be that moving forward, medical marijuana may address some of those issues.
Moving marijuana to the back burner and opioids to the front burner is the consensus there. Florida State Senator Jeff Brandes, thanks so much.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
There's a new wind blowing in government, and I don't like it.
Perhaps in these times of confusion and mistrust of government, we should hearken back to a humbler, more sincere voice of public service in the little town of Pawnee, Indiana.
All of a sudden, there's all this federal money coming in, and Paul, the city manager, is telling us to build parks, start new community programs. It's horrifying. My idea of a perfect government is one guy who sits in a small room at a desk, and the only thing he's allowed to decide is who to nuke. The man is chosen based on some kind of IQ test and maybe also a physical tournament, like a decathlon.
Ah, yes, the man Ron Swanson, who inspired millions in the TV series Parks and Recreation. Where are you now, when we need you? Well, actor and comedian Nick Offerman is moving on from the manly, freedom-loving character he knows best. Yes, he's left Pawnee. We caught him on the trail of showcasing another side of his performing career. It turns out that in real life, he's an award-winning woodworker.
The thing about a lathe, there's something very magical about it, and it's an ancient tool that hasn't changed over centuries. I mean, they've had a motor added, but I know guys that build foot-powered lathes that can turn the most beautiful vases. There's something quite wizardly about the lathe.
Offerman explores the fun and deep spiritual contentment that he says comes from working with tools in his new book, Good Clean Fun, Misadventures in Sawdust at Offerman Woodshop. It's a real woodshop in East L.A. He says the political candidates might learn some important lessons from patient woodworking, and Offerman told us he's thought a lot about how Ron Swanson would approach the 2016 election.
He would not be a fan of Trump. He would think that going – that he was a successful businessman, and to go from there into politics is a huge step backward in Ron's eyes. He also doesn't respect women, and Ron is a big fan of women because they're people who deserve basic human dignity.
And that, of course, the interaction with women is what the show is all about.
It is, you know, and I think that a lot of narrow-minded people took Ron Swanson and they just cherry-picked attributes of him, and they said, oh, he likes guns, so he must be an NRA right-winger, or – you know, he's a macho sheriff type, so he must be a misogynist, and those things are very untrue. You know, he was a great feminist. Ron probably wouldn't like Hillary either because she's a career politician, but if he had to make a choice, he would vote for Hillary.
You know, this book that you've written, Good Clean Fun, is about your work as a carpenter. I grew up in the Midwest. I knew how to use a saw, and my dad had a workshop. It seemed like everybody had a workshop in those days. You know, how close is this to your sort of background as an artist?
There's a lot of that in the book. I mean, I've somehow become sort of an evangelist for woodworking, but it's more than that. It's a way of life, and I did grow up in a family in the country. My dad taught me to use tools, and my uncles and grandfathers on their farm, but I never envisioned a life of like making furniture or anything like that. It's a very important part of my health and really my philosophy. I mean, by maintaining my life in my shop, I present myself with problems that need solving. The fun thing about woodworking is it's always a sequence of problem solving. And when you do that successfully, and you end up with a table or a kazoo or a canoe, you say, that's pretty neat that I was able to do that. And that affects the rest of my life. You know, I'm much more likely to change my own tire or, you know, when something breaks, I love to sew a button back on a garment. To me, that's something, that mentality is something that could really help our society these days. If a button fails, then I feel shame for whoever put that button on in the first place. And then it's up to me to beat their work with my replacement.
That is such a human view of objects. It really, I mean, because it embodies the object with the act of whatever the human did to make it.
And that's part of what my book is about, is bringing our mentality back from consumerism and not knowing where all of our products come from, and getting back to where you live in a community where you're actually – you're raising chickens for eggs and you trade them for a lady down the street who, you know, knits hats and whatnot. I think that'll keep us from becoming China.
This sort of mixture of the Zen of approaching life through making things as an artist and the humorous spirit of public service that comes through in Parks and Rec and Ron Swanson, I think they dovetail, if I can use that word here in this conversation.
I would appreciate it if you did.
Yeah. If Ron was asked to advise either of the candidates, and let's just say preferably both of the candidates, since we want to be as objective as we possibly can here on public radio, in these last 20 days or so before the election, what would Ron Swanson, as a public servant?
I would say I don't like to speculate at such things, because mainly the writers of Parks and Rec were so much more brilliant than me that, all, you know, in these kind of settings when people ask me to extemporize as Ron, I say, you know what, I'm not smart enough. And if I had to guess, you know, he would probably tell Trump to go hide somewhere in Europe, you know, maybe open a cobbler's shop or something. He used to advise people, you know, get a real job, like welding. And, you know, they would probably give him something to say to Hillary that, you know, would be reminiscent of a Leslie Knope scene and say, look, I don't like the government, but you take a lot of punches, and I really respect that. And I hope you get a nap here one of these days.
And Citizen Offerman?
It boils down for me to – we have two candidates. One of them has a great deal of experience at doing this job, and one of them has zero. I think it's telling that, you know, this tape thing happened with Access Hollywood, and the guy who's like a cheeseball talk show host got fired for it. But the guy running for president is attempting to walk away unscathed. I think that's pretty telling.
What's the worst thing you ever said in the locker room?
You guys ever seen one of these?
Nick Offerman, let's leave it right there. Actor, comedian, and carpenter, best known for his role as Ron Swanson in Parks and Rec, and author of the book Good, Clean, Fun, based on his work as a carpenter. Nick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
By the way, you can head over to Facebook.com/TheTakeaway to see my Facebook live conversation with Nick Offerman. It's pretty hysterical. Like our page, stay involved and get exclusive videos and interviews before they hit the airwaves. Again, that's Facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Hey, folks, these were not actors, okay, earlier this hour. We found actual undecided voters. We did.
Hi, Sheila from Michigan. And I'm so upset I can't take these three people who are undecided yet, because what they're talking about, you look at Hillary, yes, she might be a little more civilized and a little more presentable, which bodes well when it goes to talking to foreign leaders, but your people are seeing her so differently than many Americans.
If you're infuriated, we actually love that. Make sure you tune into our live call-in show, Debate Rewind. That's tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll hear from our three undecided voters again tonight. Maybe they won't be so undecided. Subscribe to and download the Takeaway podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, give us a rating. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm John Hockenberry. I'm decided. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.